Tonight we're starting Historical Apologetics, presenting historical evidences for the truth of Christianity. And this is kind of a, as any type of apologetics, any type of defense would be, it's kind of a twofold defense, where it's both offensive, where you provide arguments for Christianity, and so here will be historical arguments for Christianity, but you also present historical arguments to refute the arguments posed against Christianity. So there's an offensive and a defensive side. And when we deal with Old Testament and New Testament reliability, it's the emphasis is kind of on the defensive side, because it's the accusation is made that the Bible is not reliable, it wasn't written by eyewitnesses, there was some legendary evolution in the stories of Jesus before it was written down, so we can't get an accurate picture of Jesus from the Gospels and things of that sort. And so we set out in a defensive manner to defend the integrity of the Bible, of the Old Testament and the New Testament. And in the meantime, as we're doing that, we also pick up some positive evidences that argue in its favor. So it kind of blends both the offensive and the defensive. What I want to start with in historical apologetics, most of the historical evidences that we'll be dealing with are New Testament, but I want to spend at least a night, maybe two nights, on arguing for the reliability of the Old Testament. Let me say this, too. When you deal with ancient literature, i.e. Manuscripts dating before 200 or 300 A.D., there's no such thing as having the originals. So all we can deal with are copies of, copies that are still in existence that archaeologists have identified and found, or archaeological digs that confirm something that's reported in the Old Testament or New Testament. Now, with the Old Testament, the manuscript evidence is much worse than it is for the New Testament. It also may be the reason why, as old as the manuscripts are for the New Testament, by the way, the New Testament manuscript evidence, that's just when you compare the copies that we have in existence, ancient copies of the New Testament. The New Testament is by far the most accurate of all, has the most manuscript evidence for it. With the Old Testament, it's a little bit of a different story, and it's probably because of the Hebrew practice. When the Hebrew copyist would copy a manuscript, they would count every dotting of the I, every crossing of the T, and then they would count every letter, every stroke on every letter, and if one line, if it didn't come out right, they would just tear up the copy and start over again. So they were so meticulous in their work that by the time they completed a copy of a manuscript, they were convinced that the copy was an exact duplicate of the original or the other copy they were copying. And since it was in better shape, and what they were copying was probably starting to fall apart anyway, they would burn it out of reverence for it, much like we would burn and have a ceremony and burn the American flag rather than throw it in a dumpster. Okay? Well, you know, proper flag etiquette. And I do believe that that carried on over, since the first Christians were Jewish, that probably carried on over to the originals and maybe copies of the originals. But once you get beyond that point, then it was not uncommon for Gentile copyists, Christian copyists, to end up just leaving copies around and without knowing that, you know, 1,500 years later, 1,600 years later, we'd be finding these ancient fragments and ancient manuscripts. But the two greatest Hebrew manuscripts or manuscript families that we find in the Hebrew of the Old Testament, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which dates back to about 150 to 100 BC, found in the caves of the Qumran community, the Dead Sea community. There the Essenes withdrew from the from Jerusalem, and they believed that the worship had become so corrupted that the Messiah was going to come, and the first thing he was going to do was going to be to lambast Jerusalem. And so they withdrew from the city and believed that God no longer accepted worship from the religious establishment there. And so they started their own monastic communal lifestyle, and they had copies of their own writings that were there, as well as copies of the Hebrew Old Testament. So the Dead Sea Scrolls are the oldest Hebrew manuscripts we have, and they date back to 150 to 100 BC. Okay, now the Hebrews themselves continued throughout the centuries, continued the practice of respectfully removing the older manuscripts and keeping the newer manuscript copies. And so the standard Hebrew text today of the entire Old Testament is the Masoretic text, but that only dates back to about 1010 AD. Okay, so, I mean, you know, when you have the first five books of the Bible being written about 1500 BC, and Job possibly being written as early as 2000 BC, you know, this stuff is like 2,000 to 3,000 years after the fact. That's a substantially large gap, okay? Yet, the gap between the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, cuts that gap in half pretty much, and you've got an 1,100 year gap there. Yet when you compare the portions of the Old Testament containing the Dead Sea Scrolls, for instance, the Isaiah manuscripts, with the Masoretic text, the agreement is extremely high. Very little difference. Sometimes it's a misspelled word. And, you know, I mean, if all you're getting is just a misspelled word or the updating of the name of a city or whatever, if those are the only discrepancies you're getting over a thousand-year period, then it's safe to say that that there probably were just as few discrepancies in the thousand years before that. So comparing the Dead Sea Scrolls with the Masoretic text is a very... It gives us some really good information about the reliability of the manuscripts that we have for the Old Testament, even though the dates are rather late, obviously much later than we would like. But the oldest Old Testament manuscripts that we have, actually the Septuagint, dating to 250 to 150 years before Christ, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament, okay? And this is real important, too, because the Septuagint was the Bible of the early church, especially after 70 AD, but even before, you find... Well, I would probably argue that... after 70 AD, the Septuagint became, you know, the destruction of the temple and maybe even going back as far as Paul's missionary journeys and the Gospels being spread more rapidly among the Gentiles than among the Jews, that all of a sudden the Septuagint became the leading translation there. But you'll find many quotes of the Old Testament in our New Testament that does not agree with our Old Testament. And in those cases, almost always, if not in every case, for all I know, I haven't done the necessary research to make such a bold statement, but in most cases at least, though the New Testament quote doesn't match perfectly with the Old Testament passage that's being quoted, it is a perfect match if you're quoting it from the Alexandrian text of the Septuagint, the Greek translation. And now Jesus and the apostles probably did not use the Septuagint. They probably used the Hebrew version, but what I'm getting at is that the Septuagint was translated from Hebrew copies that were much older and probably much more reliable than the manuscripts that went into the Masoretic text. Okay? So, having said that too, Justin, I actually had my own little theory that the Jewish rabbis, when Jesus fulfilled so many specific Old Testament prophecies of the Messiah, that they went back and retranslated and sometimes even changed a few of the passages. And I know that's a bold claim, but it just seemed to me like the Septuagint was so right on and the Hebrew manuscripts are so far off. And if God inspires the author of Hebrews to quote from the Old Testament, he's going to inspire him to quote from the right Old Testament copy. Then I found out that that's exactly what Justin Martyr in the late 2nd century AD was arguing in the dialogue with a Jewish rabbi. He was arguing that it was common knowledge that many of the rabbis had actually changed a few passages because they were too clearly fulfilled by Christ. An example is Psalm 22, where King David is prophesying. You know, it starts out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? You got Christ on the cross utters that. They cast lots for my garments, and they pierced my hands and my feet. In the Masoretic text, instead of they pierced my hands and my feet, it reads like a lion, my hands and my feet. And that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. It makes so little sense that when we translate it in our Old Testament today, we just say, hey, Septuagint has to be right here. Okay? So that was such a blatant error that, or such a blatant change that we just go with the Septuagint on that. But for the most part, we go with the Hebrew text. And I think when we do that, we run into some problems. Let me just give you one example. You can do a study on that someday, though. Take Old Testament passages quoted in the New Testament and see how many of them.
I know there's some. I remember reading something about that. There are names in the Septuagint that aren't like Balaam and Samson and names like those aren't in the Hebrew, but they're in the Septuagint.
Wow.
They weren't originally in there. So you're right. I was wondering about that. You just confirmed me.
Yep.
Okay.
And I think when it's clearly a messianic prophecy, you actually have motive on the part of the rabbis to do some changing there. Let me see if I can find that passage real quick. It's a quote.
The church fathers believe that it was inspired writing by the Holy Spirit. I don't know.
The Septuagint?
Yeah, the supposed 72 scribes.
The Jews actually held to that viewpoint, the ancient Jews, but
doesn't the legend go that each in pairs, locked into rooms, and when they were in 36 days, when they were done translating, they came out so exact that it was like.
Yeah, there's all sorts of legends around it, and the Septuagint gets its name from the 70, and you had the 70 members of the Sanhedrin, you had the 70 judges under Moses, so 70 was a real key number, and so I don't doubt that they used 70 guys, but certainly some of the stories about it are legendary at best. But whatever the case, it does seem to me that you had guys who knew the Hebrew language real well, had become very versed with the Greek language, and they had access to better manuscripts than we do today. And then I would throw in that after 30 AD, you could argue, I think you could make a case like Justin Martyr did in about 170 AD. He made a case that Jewish rabbis had actually changed. With the Hebrew, there's no vowels. There were no vowels originally in the written language. So vowel points were added later, and then you didn't break up the words. You didn't separate the letters of each word from each other. So, I think Joshua Dowell uses the example: God is nowhere, and God is now here. That if you just break it in a different place, you change the meaning totally. But the context usually determines how it's broken up, which means you should argue for they pierced my hands and my feet, not like a lion, my hands and my feet. If you break it up in such a way that it makes no sense at all, then it's time to look for an alternative. But they pierced my hands and my feet sounds too much like Jesus of Nazareth. Whatever the case, let me give you the example from Hebrews 10. You might want to look there. Hebrews 10, and in verse, starting in verse 5, going through verse 7, it says, "Therefore, when he came into the world, he said," so speaking of Christ, okay, and then he begins to quote from Psalm 46 to 8. So we'll look at this and then we'll look at Psalm 46 to 8. "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, but a body you have prepared for me. In burnt offerings and sacrifice for sin you had no pleasure. Then I said, behold, I have come. In the volume of the book it is written of me to do your will, O God." Now that obviously sounds like a prophecy of Jesus the Messiah. Okay? When you go to the Alexandrian text of the Greek Septuagint, lo and behold, that's what you have, word for word. Okay? Now when you look at that, Jesus is saying, look, the animal sacrifices you don't desire, but instead you've prepared a body for me, the incarnation. Okay? You took no pleasure in animal sacrifices. So then I said, I have come. I've come to earth in the incarnation. And in the book, in the scroll, in God's word, it is written of me to do your will, O God. So, I mean, it sounds very clearly, you know, Christ is saying that the Bible is written about him and that God prepared a body for him because animal sacrifices were not sufficient to atone for our sins. So then you go back to Psalm 40. Verses 6 to 8. And that reads, "Sacrifice and offering you did not desire, my ears you have opened." And the rest of it pretty much reads the same. "Burnt offering and sin offering you did not require. Then I said, behold, I come. In the scroll of the book it is written of me. I delight to do your will, O my God. And your law is written within my heart." So the significant change there is that instead of a body you have prepared for me, it's my ears you have opened. Some translations would read, my ears you have pierced. It doesn't really make a whole lot of sense. And I see some great Christian commentators really going way out on a limb just to try to make sense out of it. I think it's safer to say that if God inspired the author of Hebrews to write the book of Hebrews, and I believe he did, and he inspired the author of Hebrews to quote from Psalm 40, 6 to 8, and I believe he did, then he's going to guide him to an accurate translation or an accurate copy. Okay? And so there's an example. You just throw that one monkey wrench in there. My ears you have opened, rather than but a body you have prepared for me. And it just, you know, it takes a very, very clear messianic prophecy and makes it very, very vague. Now, I'm not saying that the Septuagint automatically is more accurate in every reading, every passage, than the Hebrew text, whether it's in the Dead Sea Scrolls or the Masoretic text. However, I would say that, you know, that might be the case, because it's older, so even though it's a translation, it was translated from older Hebrew copies. Okay, that's number one. So the copies were older. Number two, the motivation to change those Old Testament prophecies of the Messiah was not there yet, since Jesus had yet arrived on the scene. You know, he didn't come for another 200 years. And number three, you know, God inspires many of the authors in the New Testament to quote from it. So at least in those passages, I think it should be a no-brainer that the Greek Septuagint is more accurate in those areas, at least. Okay.
The translators did have the library, the Alexandrian Library, before the Romans burned it down. 400,000 volumes.
Yeah. Well, even with the, I was just telling my students today that a good argument that Matthew and Luke were written before 70 A.D. and that there's good arguments that you can argue for Matthew being written in the 30s A.D. and Luke written about 59 A.D., but just the fact that they had genealogies that went back as far as Abraham and Matthew and as far as Adam in Luke showed that they had to have a place to store all of these. I mean, you didn't even own your own Bible. You couldn't carry lug all these scrolls with you. So the most likely place for them to have been stored and all sorts of records were stored was in the temple. I mean, in the temple, just in the outer porch, like Solomon's colonnade, you could fit thousands of people. I mean, that's where Peter preached and 3,000 people got saved. You know, it makes you wonder how many people heard him. 3,000 got saved, there could have been 10,000 people there. And so the temple was, the whole temple area was a huge, huge place. But they had plenty of places for storage, and that's the most likely place for them to store genealogical records, especially of Judean Jews. And that's why the slam kept coming on Christ, you know, hey, out here from Galilee. There's no prophet from Galilee, you know, they're ignoring Jonah. But they're acting like the Messiah. Can't come from Galilee. He's got to come from Judea, the Judean area, the tribe of David, which is the tribe of Judah. Well, Jesus was from the tribe of Judah, just that when his family moved back into Egypt after Herod the Great died, they found out one of his sons was sitting on a throne in Judea, so the angel told him to go up and live in Galilee. And so their family line, the Davidic line, was the Judean line, so the records were probably kept in the temple. And so you can make a really good case, because now Jews cannot do that. They cannot trace their lineage all the way back to their tribe. They can say, well, I'm from the tribe of Benjamin, because that's what my father told me, and his father told him that, and his father as far back as we can remember, but they don't have it written down generation by generation all the way back to Abraham. And
I think there's two passages in the New Testament that indicate that some of them might, when Paul was standing before Felix, he pleaded the case that we 12 tribes or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's another place too, one of the letters, I think it was by Paul. So I think some of them may have still probably
know their lineage. What I'm saying is after 70 A.D., and see, right after 70 A.D., the temple gets destroyed.
All the records.
So the genealogical records get destroyed. But you still probably have three or four generations that have enough remembrance to trace it back pretty far, but that, you know, with, and it, so basically what I'm saying is, Paul Lewis from the tribe of Benjamin, you probably have Jews to this day who could tell you what tribe they're from with a high degree of probability, just because it's been passed on to them. Now, hopefully, you know, 10 generations ago, they didn't have a guy that was, you know, loved to tell baloney stories and just made up that he was from the tribe of Benjamin when really he was, you know, from another tribe, okay? But but the fact that you could list everybody in your genealogy all the way to Adam or at least to Abraham, you don't find that.
I know we believe that Scripture is inspired, just like God may have conveyed to Moses how creation was, and there we got the Genesis account. Couldn't the Holy Spirit have given that to one of the apostles, that, hey, this is where Christ came from, and Luke wrote it down, dictated from some...
Certainly it could have, but it doesn't... I don't get the impression that that was the case there. In fact, even Moses in Genesis... very strongly implies, you know, the generations of Adam. There's several different books that that Moses is referring to that were records kept from even before the flood and then even after the flood. And any good commentary on Genesis will show that, yeah, that it's a lot more evident in the Hebrew than it is in the English. Basically, it's just like I believe that, Job was not a Jew. Job may have been a contemporary of Abraham, but wasn't a relative of Abraham. And, that may have been a book that Moses brought with him out of the library in Egypt, one of the libraries in Egypt, acknowledging that this is that God is speaking in that book, and he may have also brought with them from probably their own libraries in the land of Goshen in Egypt, where the Jews themselves had some ancient records, probably that Noah brought with them on the ark, and then records that Abraham had passed down to Isaac and to Jacob, and that the 12 tribes kept, and the genealogical records would be like the kind of one aspect of them. The thing is too is when you read Luke talks about referring to other historical evidence. So by God inspiring Luke, it doesn't, you know, we don't hold to the dictation theory that God had to dictate every word in the Bible, and so that all the humans were just pens and just writing, you know. At the same time, there were times that God did dictate things. Thus saith the Lord, you know, I am the Lord thy God, thou shalt not have strange gods before me, and you know, Moses is taking notes, okay? So, but for the most part, it was God inspiring a human author like Luke to do his homework, his historical research, or God giving a guy a vision that the guy put in his own words. So you find the vocabulary and the temperament of Paul much different than the vocabulary and the temperament of John. Now, if John wrote early, you might find the same temperament. Just look at John the Apostle and his brother James. Some guys disagreed with the apostles and with Jesus, so they said, hey, should we call down fire from heaven and you know, away with these guys? So Jesus nicknamed them the Sons of Thunder, because these guys had an attitude, you know, follow Jesus or burn, you know? Well, that was exactly Paul's attitude. Paul's teacher, Gamaliel, said, hey, give these Christians a chance here, and it probably wasn't because Gamaliel liked the Christians, it was just because the Christians were really making the Sadducees, the rivals of the Pharisees, look bad. Because they warned them, don't preach in the name of Jesus. They went right out and did it, and it made these guys look bad. So instead of backing the Sadducees and saying, yeah, put them to death, they disobeyed you, and then we can't allow that to happen, he was like, no, come on, let's cut them some slack, and that way, you know, makes the Sadducees look bad. But he said, you know, hey, it's a messy, this guy claimed to be the Messiah. If his movement really is of God, it will last. If it's not of God, not really fade away. It'll come down like a ton of bricks. See, where we misunderstand Gamaliel and his wisdom there is most commentators see him as saying, well, if it lasts long, it's got to be true. So then on that argument, Buddhism would be true, Hinduism would be true, Islam would be true, Judaism that rejects Christ would be true. But it's not really Gamaliel's argument. He's not saying, hey, any religious movement that lasts long has to be... What he's saying is, any serious Jewish messianic movement, if it lasts, it has to be of God. Reason being, the Messiah is supposed to conquer the Roman Empire. So eventually a guy claiming to be Messiah has to round up his followers and attack Rome, and everyone that had done that had been, you know, demolished. And so he's basically saying that, you know, let's sit back and watch. And if these guys conquer the Romans, you know, so it's actually a good test. You know, but the problem is, it's like Gamaliel, if you wait for the guy that Peter and John and James believed to be the Jewish Messiah, if you wait for him to come back and conquer the Romans, the Roman Empire, and all the enemies of the Jews, when he does that, it's going to be too late to say, okay, now I accept you as the Messiah. Certainly he had given enough evidence, especially in the Jerusalem area, but Paul there was like, forget it, Gamaliel, here's where we part ways. I think we ought to go out and kill these Christians. If this guy's not the Messiah and they think he is, they're idolaters. Basically, I think if John's emphasis on love and his humility, not to even mention his own name in his gospel, which is one of the strongest arguments that it was his gospel, when he was one of the two guys who was saying, hey, let us sit on your right and left hand, okay, it showed that, you know, decades of being conformed into Christ's image, and so that it even molded his temperament. Now I'm not saying Paul was sinful in his go right zeal and his go for the jugular vein and his argumentation, but that was, you know, God figured with Paul, I can use that temperament. With John, I'm going to use him for other purposes, and he's going to emphasize love. And by the end of his life, they said all he would ever say was love one another. So, I mean, you aren't going to get a major sermon out of him. It just his whole emphasis had shifted to just loving one another, you know, within the church, within the household of God. But whatever the case, those are the Old Testament manuscripts that we have. So let me say this. The primary evidence for the reliability of the New Testament is manuscript evidence. That's kind of the internal test. You go to the manuscripts themselves. And beyond that, you can go to other writings to confirm it, the apostolic fathers, the pupils of the apostles, when the apostles selected to lead the early church, their pupils who led the early church after them. Then ancient secular writers, what did they say that the early church believed? What about the ancient creeds found in the New Testament? You know, the list goes on and on, all the different evidences. And certainly there are archaeological evidences for the New Testament. But for the New Testament, primarily, it's manuscript evidence. For the Old Testament, on the other hand, since the manuscripts don't go far enough back or close enough to when the originals were written, the primary evidence is actually archaeological evidence
for
the Old Testament.
About the Dead Sea Scrolls, is the Jewish do have the time. I know you got it here. It says the Jewish being translated to 250 to 150. Some of it was still being translated even until Christ's time. But those were some of the other books, the Apocrypha and even Esther. The original Septuagint didn't have Esther. And if I'm correct, when they found the Dead Sea Scrolls, Esther was in there too. And I do have doubts, personal doubts about Esther. I've been trying to study that book, researched it. You know, God's name's not in it. Yahweh's not in there. And it's God doesn't speak, nothing. It's just, it's, and then when I've read the Apocrypha, and it sounds more like an apocryphal book. Not that it's apocryphal, but it sounds more...
I think you can make a case, and the rabbis, certainly the rabbis of the Council of Jamnia, and the exact date escapes me at this point. I don't remember if it was around 70 A.D. or, and but that council lists 22 books, which really, because they combine 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, and they combine a few other books, it comes out to the exact 39 books that we have in our Protestant Old Testament today. So I do think the evidence is strong for it, but I think actually, you know, the fact that God's name is not mentioned...
It's not quoted anywhere.
Yeah.
Nobody refers to Esther.
Yeah.
I mean, she did such a great deed. She's not even in the Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11.
Well, but I do think that the arguments like that were probably the same arguments that were being used to keep it out originally.
I think it was just more tradition that they kept it. I mean, they have a holiday in her honor...
I personally think that God wanted it included in his canon. I mean, when you see how the books, the extra books that the Roman Catholics added, how that came about, that was obviously unjustified.
Yeah, and there was a lot more
but
protest from the fathers and the ancient Jews.
And then the Catholics only added it as supplemental reading until the Counter-Reformation, until 1546 to 1566. It was not considered on the same level, even among Roman Catholics. Well, you had guys like Augustine arguing that it should be real early on. It was the minority view within the church. But basically what I'm getting at is it seems to me like God had his hand on Esther being in there, and I think the main theme is that is God's protection of his chosen nation even when all odds are against them. And you see God's what was the key phrase in Esther? Something like, for a time such as this. That basically God had prepared her, had given her all her beauty, and had given her the qualities that the king saw in her to select her to be the queen for the sole purpose. You know, she came into existence and was blessed with the qualities that she was blessed with for the sole purpose of rescuing the Jews from extermination. So, to me, I see. I see God all over that book. But you'll see other books with it. Ecclesiastes sounds almost like it was written by a schizophrenic who, at times, was an atheist existentialist who saw no God, no life after death, no meaning to life. And then the very next sentence, he's saying they God put eternity in their hearts, and you know, and that type of thing.
Well,
but
I can see a lot in that book. But on the books of Solomon, Song of Solomon,
I
say this is a good allegory of Solomon saying, you know, that lover is God and the bride is the church. You read that book and it's even stronger than Hebrew. Oh man, me and Mark researched it. Oh my goodness, it's almost pornographic. I think Solomon was really just writing about one of his favorite wives.
It's like David just going through experiences. I feel horrible. God, how could you have forsaken me? And he starts saying, I feel like, you know, they pierced my hands and my feet. They cast lots for my garments. And David, I can see David looking back at Psalm 22 and saying, man, why did he even write that? I mean, it's just like, I was pouring my heart out to God and he gave me these words, but they don't make any sense because they really didn't literally apply to me at all. Well, 1,000 years later, you know, when Jesus said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The guy would have said, hey, I remember reading that in Psalm 22. If they go back to Psalm 22, they would see that it's eyewitness testimony. It sounds like an eyewitness account of Christ's crucifixion from the victim's perspective. And so I do think it's very clear that Solomon was basically writing a play about his love for one of his wives, a lady that he married and all, and he saw in it this beautiful play. And I think it shows that sexual relations within marriage are honored by God. I think it shows that God is into using the arts. You know, automatically the arts and drama, things like that, are not automatically from Satan. But I think there was something in there that Solomon, like Caiaphas, who said that, you know, one man must perish so that the whole nation will be saved. Well, he didn't mean it the way God meant it. But God still, and I think Solomon meant it one way, just a romance play. But I think God meant it another way because, I mean, here you got this shepherd guy falls in love with this beautiful but common lady. And she's poor. And he promises her, shepherd lover promises her, I'm going to come back for you someday and make you my bride. And she dreams about him and longs for him and desires him. But the days go on and she just keeps waiting and waiting and waiting. And then one day there's a big commotion and there's all these troops coming and chariots and coming through her little town. And then all of a sudden, there's King Solomon riding a chariot in all his majesty and all his glory, a tremendous entrance into her city, and he stops his chariot right in front of her house and then steps down and walks up to her to take her hand and they ask her to be his bride. And she looks at him and she's shocked that why would the king of Israel do that, ask me to be his bride, and all of a sudden she recognizes her shepherd lover. Now, Solomon may not have realized that, but I think right there is that, you know, the good shepherd returns as king for his bride, and the bride longs for her king to return. So I agree with, like, Merrill Unger that even if Solomon, and he probably didn't, even if he didn't understand what was being said, that was there. But let me say this, too. This is something that I went over with my Religions of the World class at King's West. I had the question. C.S. Lewis believed that God placed the idea of a kind of a general outline of a fairy tale in the hearts of all people, so that we all, you know, when we daydream about, being a hero and that type of thing, and a single guy who isn't going steady with a girl or anything like that will sometimes daydream about, you know, rescuing a girl and being her hero, and she falls in love with him and they get married and they live happily ever after and stuff like that. We all got this idea, and creative people spell it out in a drama or a fairy tale or a legend or whatever. And C.S. Lewis argued that that's the outline of the gospel that God wrote on our hearts, so that when we hear the greatest story ever told, it matches so perfectly that we say, the bride is being tormented by the dragon, but someday the prince will come, defeat the dragon, rescue his bride, and they'll live happily ever after. And so one of my students, a very bright girl who loves the Lord, said, don't you think that C.S. Lewis was reading too much of his Christianity back into the fairy tale? And I said, well, I tell you what, let's watch a movie, a cartoon, The Lion King, where Walt Disney, when they talked to the directors and the producers and the